Talk is entitled Turning Drains into Sponges and Scarcity into Abundance. So I'll be talking about water and rainwater harvesting through the lens of the situation in my hometown of Tucson, Arizona, where we get 12 inches of rain in an average year, or 304 millimeters in an average year. And while that's a dry land environment, the principles that I will convey in the talk are universal for wet climates as well. And in addition, although I'm focusing a lot around Tucson and southern Arizona, the water situation is very similar to many communities throughout the western United States and much of the world. So I want to compare these two images. They're both taken of my hometown of Tucson. And the one on the left was taken in 1904. The one on the right was taken in 2007. So here is the Santa Cruz River. It used to run year-round. That's why Tucson is located where it is. And then you can see today it's now just a dry river. It no longer flows unless there's a break in the sewer line which runs below it, or for a few days after a major rain. So the big difference is the loss of that river in this 100-year period, but also back in 1904, we had whole neighborhoods named Flowing Wells, Sabino Springs, after the artesian wells and the springs that used to flow year-round. Most of those are all gone now, too. And another thing that's disappeared is the sponge of the watershed. So in the early 1900s, particularly in these areas of the intact mesquite, bosque, or mesquite forest, the vegetation was so dense that when the rain fell from the sky, the erosive force of the falling drop would be broken up by the canopy of vegetation. The drop would make its way more slowly to the soil below and be readily absorbed by the mulchy sponge layer below. Whereas today, we've paved over 25% of Tucson. That's actually a 10-year-old statistic, so it's probably closer to 30% now. And as Andy Lipkus mentioned, LA is over 60% paved, so it's a common phenomenon to pave over our watersheds and to harden the arteries of our waterways. So what has resulted in the reason for this loss of the river and the springs and the wells and the bosque is many reasons, but two I'll focus on is, first, we overconsume our water, our groundwater. We pump it out at a much more rapid rate than it is naturally recharged. So the groundwater was about 3 to 4 feet beneath the surface in the early 1900s in some parts of the basin. Now it's over 300 feet beneath the surface. Continues to drop at a rate of 3 to 4 feet per year in the basin. And while we're over-consuming the water, we're simultaneously crippling the watershed's ability to naturally recharge itself because we're paving over much of the surface. And whether it's the official pavement of streets, sidewalks, buildings, and so on, or the unofficial pavement of the denuded areas that are now so compacted they act like adobe brick patios. So while we get 12 inches of rain in a year, much of that now, the bulk of that runs off. Okay, let's look closer at our watershed today. This is evidence of a hydrophobic society. We are afraid of water, as was mentioned in the talk before. You can see in many of our commercial developments, we pave almost all of it. And in our housing developments, we put our houses on the high side, good, but we drain the water right off the landscape into the street and into the concrete-lined storm drain, and the guns of Navarone-like drains shoot the water right out of the system. So that then, so we're literally, we, the people, are literally dehydrating our watershed. We then send the water off the surfaces where it would be a resource, our landscapes, our parks, our farms, and so on, and we send it into the street where it's a liability. So this is a real problem, but there's a real potential boon in this if we recognize the value of stormwater kayaking in the urban setting. But until we do, we've got an issue. So, whoops, got the slide sideways. Now, when I talk about harvesting rainwater, oftentimes people will laugh at me if I'm in the dryland environment, because they say, well, what rain do you want to harvest? Well, as you can see, there's quite a bountiful amount of water And I won't read that off, let you guys read it. Other than the one figure, 1 inch of rain falling on the surface area of Tucson equals almost 4 billion gallons of rainwater. Okay, so basically I see we can take one of two paths. We can take the path on the left, which is the wasteful path to scarcity, where basically what we're doing is we've set up the infrastructure and all in such a way that we're draining the water out and typically sending it into our access ways, causing flooding. We're also draining our household gray water out of the system. So over time, the landscape gets more eroded, we lose topsoil, we lose water, and things are steadily worsening. And we might start to become more aware of that, be concerned of it, maybe even scared, and hey, what do you know, we're scared to live in the city. That's the path to scarcity, scared to be in the city. Thank you. Okay, and we can instead take the stewardship path to abundance on the right, and we just tweak it a little. It's basically the same setup, but instead of planting on mounds that drain water and all away, and topsoil, we plant in sunken basins, and the raised part is now the access way. So we use the access way as the catchment, draining the water to adjoining air sponges where we infiltrate and utilize the water to grow a greater density and diversity of vegetation, which can grow food, passively cool the house, and so on. Household gray water is also sent here. So we actually become a producer of resources rather than a net consumer. And so over time, things get better rather than worse. We might become aware of that, become really happy, so happy. We might even want to do a little dance. We might even do a little bun dance because it's the path to a bun dance, okay? All right. Whoops, I got another slide sideways. Okay, so here's two examples of scarcity or abundance. The one on the left is a typical Tucson street, 40 feet wide or more. You can see that there's no trees planted in the public right-of-way, only in the private property. So we have this massive surface of exposed hardscape that absorbs heat during the day from the sun, radiates it out at night. This has contributed to a rise in urban temperatures of 10 degrees in Phoenix since the 1940s and a rise of 6 degrees in Tucson. Whereas Davis, California, you got to look sideways, I put it in wrong, you can see they are shading over 75% of the street with the vegetation planted alongside a narrower street, and the runoff from that street is what irrigates those trees. They've done studies finding that rather than creating the heat island effect, which is the example here, this creates the cool island effect, and they've reduced summertime temperatures by 10 degrees. Okay, pick what you want. So let's look closer at the landscape. The one on the left is taking the path to scarcity. That's a landscape on intensive care. And then the one on the right is the path to abundance. So what's happening here is we're taking the roof runoff, sending it right past the plants into the street and the storm drain. We plant on mounds, we drain water, topsoil, everything away. We got to bring in intravenous-like drip irrigation emitters to replace the vital fluids and care packages of fertilizer. Whereas the path on the right, we plant within sunken or beside sunken earthworks, so the water infiltrates rather than runs off. The runoff is directed into those earthworks. Should one fill, it overflows to the next, and the next, only the overflow goes to the storm drain. And we also have another water source of the runoff from the hardscape. So in an instance like this, especially in a dryland environment, you can triple your available rainfall because you're getting the rain that falls from the sky infiltrating. You're getting the same surface area of rain falling on the roof that goes to the landscape and the same amount of surface area on the hardscape, sidewalks, driveways, so on, that goes to the landscape. So this then leads to a challenge, and I'm focusing primarily on rainwater harvesting in the landscape because that's the easiest place to begin. You don't have to worry about the water quality issues. And so 30 to 50% of the potable drinking water consumed in an average single family home in the western United States is used for irrigation. So if you take on the challenge, which is to break away from using drinking water as your primary water source, and instead use rainwater as the primary source, household gray water as the secondary source, and in gray water, I also include air conditioning condensate and evaporative cooler bleed off and reverse osmosis bleed off. And then use municipal or well water only as a supplementary source, we can reduce our potable water consumption by over 30%. Okay, and another way to further the potential of all this And to push the sustainability is to follow 8 simple principles, which I will cover very fast, but you can read them in the book and the proceedings to get more. So the first is long and thoughtful observation. How much time do I have? I have 4 minutes. All right, I'm not even, that's that one. Start at the top of your watershed and work your way down, that's 2. Start small and simple. Why? Well, you just might start. Slow, spread, and infiltrate the water. Zigzag it. Don't send it right out. Always have an overflow and use it as a resource. Maximize the sponge, basically. Get everything to do more than one thing. And the feedback loop, the same as the first principle, long and thoughtful observation. Let's see some examples. But first, go beyond harvesting water. Integrate your design, okay? So if you're going to create these water harvesting earthworks, where do you want to put them? And where do you put the plantings? Focus on the east, west, and north of the building. This image is taken in the summer months, and the sun rises and sets at our latitude. Once you're 20 degrees latitude and up north, it rises to the north of due east and west in the summer months, and it rises and sets to the south of due east and west in the winter months. So in the summer, you're getting shade most of the day, and in the winter, you're getting sun most of the day. So this helps passively cool you in summer and passively warm you and heat you in winter. So when you're putting in these earthworks, here's the east, north, and west side. Put them in there. Have the lower growing vegetation on the south. You can have a cistern. And then the earthworks take roof runoff, surrounding soil runoff, direct rainfall, and then via the dotted line pipe, household gray water. And the shaded area, I focus that within 30 feet of the house because I want to have more of this oasis effect closer to both the water source and the people that are going to enjoy it. Gray water, just flash that. Well, I prefer to do gray water systems that just send the water to level-bottomed mulched basins. There's no filter other than the soil and the living organisms within the system. Okay, and it's gravity feed. I never store gray water. I just send it right to the landscape so there's no smell and the living system filters it. It's legal in Arizona and New Mexico to harvest your gray water, and there's even tax incentives, and I encourage you to look to Arizona and New Mexico's models. For your access ways, always raise them, sink the adjoining planted areas, and utilize the water within to shade over the access ways. Here's an example of how you can use the rainwater or maximize runoff and rainwater. Looking along freeways, you'll see the bigger trees are beside the runoff generator, bigger than the trees further off. And this is in a very arid environment. There's no trees, not enough water for it, but you have yuccas right along the dirt road, whereas you don't once you get beyond. Okay. Okay. Eat your rainwater. That's what my brother's doing, along with his gray water. Do I even have time, or should I? Okay. This is a single-family household. Just want to show you some examples implementing the principles and doing this. I'll show you a single family household, a multi-family, and some streetscape applications. So we want to turn that into this. The way we did it is we planted everything in mulched basins. We raised the pathways. This cistern provides the water for this garden. 10 out of the past 11 years, it's only received rainwater. But the cistern does more than harvest rainwater. It's put on the western property boundary, so it doubles as privacy fence. It's also a privacy screen. On the other side of that tank is the neighbor's rental unit. They have a bay window. Always had great neighbors. One neighbor always loved to hang out there and wave and check us out every time we went out into the garden. So we put a cistern in front of his view, planted the other side of the cistern, so he has a new view now. So the cistern is a privacy screen as well as a storage vessel. It's also a great fire break for the sketchy wiring next door. So if we're going to have a fire, it's going to come from there. Ferro cement tank won't burn, filled with water, do great. It's a high mass tank for the cold intolerant citrus tree. It absorbs heat during the day, radiates it out at night, so we don't have frost problems with the citrus. And the tree and the cistern are on the western property boundary of the garden, or on the west side of the garden. So they act as sunscreens. They shade out the garden in the afternoon when the ambient temperatures are higher and we would be losing more water through evapotranspiration having heat stress. Okay, and there's a few other things, but we don't have time. For our gray water, we want to make it really simple. Every time we do a load of wash, we move the drain hose into a different pipe Each pipe is labeled with a tree that gets the water. You could have one more pipe that says sewer or septic. So if you use nasty stuff like bleach, you can put that to the sewer. When you use the appropriate soaps, you can send it to the landscape. It gives you a lot of control. If the orange needs more water, you just leave it on there for two loads. Okay. This is how it works. You got the drains each going to a separate mulched basin, and then there's the sewer pipe that would go off to the sewer. Okay. This is what we grow with our rainwater and our gray water. We produce 15 to 25% of our food on site doing that. This is the public right-of-way. We move beyond the property. This is what it was in 1994. And then we started planting trees within earthworks. This is what it looked like in 2006. Can't even see the house anymore. So we did irrigate the vegetation the first few years to get it established. Once established, we ceased all irrigation. So it's now irrigated entirely by rainwater. Doesn't mean anything here in Hawaii. You do that all the time. But it means a lot back in Arizona. And we use primarily native species, which made it very easy. So this is an island of the Sonoran Desert ecosystem within the urban core. We only had pigeons when we started this. Now we have over 24 resident native bird species, and we harvest a lot of food from there and a lot more. I don't have time to tell you. But we wanted to get even more water, and we looked to the street, and we realized streets are ephemeral waterways. Let's treat them as such, and let's plant the native vegetation that naturally grows along ephemeral waterways, okay? So all our streets can become green belts if we direct the runoff from the street to the adjoining right-of-way, in which we can infiltrate that water and then grow native vegetation. So you can read that, but basically on my street, for every in 1 year, the street generates 1 million gallons of runoff per mile. Okay, that's enough water to sustain. that's enough water to sustain 422 trees per mile, or one tree every 25 feet on both sides of the street. Okay, and you might think, well, I'm in an area with a whole different rainfall regime. Well, you use your native species, which are adapted to your rainfall regime. This is my sister-in-law eating the food grown off the rainwater runoff from the street in here. And we wanted to share this with the community, so we have this mesquite mill. Go to desertharvesters.org to see how you grind the mesquite pods into edible flour. The mesquite is a native tree that produces this edible thing, right? And we want people to not only grind it, but to enjoy it. So we have a mesquite, we have this big, you gotta make it public, you gotta have fun, celebrate it. So we have these mesquite pancake fiestas with live music, and we're grinding the pods, and people really get excited when it tastes this good, you know, and you pass it through your lower intestine. You really want to share this information with other people, okay? And prickly pear syrup and all. Okay, should I just stop? Okay. Yeah, it's all in the book and the other and. There's so much more, I don't have time, but thanks a lot.